Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all packed into a concise, informative update. It's Friday, the 12th of April. Coming up on the program, new legislation to help fight workplace corruption. I'll talk to the head as well of the SIU about cross-border corruption and a new plan that's in place. The scourge of ongoing company liquidations in South Africa, and will road maintenance be compromised now that e-toll gantries are dark? Let's start with this, and President Ramaphosa has assented to the Judicial Matters Amendment Act of 2023, and in one respect, it's going to have a major bearing on fighting corruption in the workplace. I want to make some sense of this with Zakir Mohammed of CMS Law. A very warm welcome to you, Zakir. And first of all, what are the provisions, and how do you believe the landscape is going to change?
Yeah, thank you very much, Jeremy. If I can take you back to our piece of corruption legislation, we've got the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. It's been South Africa's primary piece of anti-corruption legislation for the last 10 years. Quite a comprehensive piece of legislation, has a general offence of corruption followed by numerous specific provisions of corrupt activities. Our legislation has been unique in that we've had a duty to report corrupt activities in Section 34 of the Act that's been around for the last 10 years. It basically places a duty on persons in a position of authority to report, suspicions of offences of theft, fraud, corruption, extortion, forgery, uttering a forged document involving an amount of 100,000 rand or more to the DPCI, or we know them as the Hawks. So that provision's been around. The Judicial Matters Amendment Act that's just been passed by the President has now introduced a new section in our corruption legislation, which is Section 34A. And Section 34A is aptly titled Failure by Members of the Private Sector or Incorporated State-Owned Entities to Prevent Corrupt Activities. And basically, this is quite a unique provision in that what it provides is that any member of the private sector or an incorporated state-owned entity would be guilty of an offense if a person associated with that member basically committed an offense of corruption by paying a bribe in order to retain business for that member or to obtain an advantage in the conduct of business for that particular member. Quite a unique provision. There is a defensible position that an entity would have. And so basically, if an entity had what is termed adequate procedures designed to prevent persons associated with them from engaging in such conduct, then that would be a defense for them in terms of this particular section.
All right. So let me pick you up on a couple of issues there. First of all, what would those procedures entail, and how difficult would it be to implement those?
Yeah, so those particular procedures initially found its way in the United Kingdom's Bribery Act when they enacted their piece of anti-corruption legislation. And in the United Kingdom, they issued 6 guiding principles of what those adequate procedures would be. And it seems that a similar approach has now been adopted in our Anti-Corruption Act. And basically, there isn't currently any local guidance, and so it's advisable that organizations adopt the same adequate procedures as is seen in the guiding principles that one finds in the United Kingdom. And these adequate procedures are not necessarily difficult to implement in an organization. I'll just unpack each of them. The first one is proportionality, and proportionality is basically an organization implementing measures to address corruption risks based on the level of corruption risks that they may face, given the size of the business, the industry they operate in, as well as the nature of the business activities that they would conduct. The second one, and it's a very important one, top-level commitment. There has to be a commitment at board level, at senior management level, to address issues of corruption and corrupt activity. The third one is risk assessment, conducting a detailed risk assessment to identify what specific corruption risks you may face as an organization, as well as ranking those risks, you know, so that you can address them meaningfully. The third one is due diligence, and this is another very important one. And this is basically conducting due diligence on your business partners, as well as your agents and your third-party service providers, and extending it further to ensure that you vet your employees as well at your recruitment stage.
All right, so Zakir, if I can just drop in there, all of these sound like very positive moves in the right direction, particularly given the endemic corruption that South Africa faces. What do you believe the immediate impact on business is going to be?
I think the immediate impact is businesses are now, by law, faced with the concept that they now have to do this, not just from a practical perspective to mitigate corruption risks, but from a regulatory perspective as well. Because if they don't have these measures in place, they could be guilty of an offense, specifically if any one of their members have been engaging in this kind of conduct. And so now it's a real regulatory risk for these organizations, in addition to the financial and reputational consequences that they may suffer as a result of corrupt activity.
All of this, of course, is predicated on the ability to enforce this, and that is something that often we fall short in this country.
Absolutely. I think over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of criticism about the enforcement of our legislation. I always say we do have world-class legislation, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I think we're starting to see that work getting done in terms of moving towards enforcing our legislation a lot more better.
So when does all of this take hold?
So this amendment has come into effect immediately. So as we're speaking, our organizations really need to make sure that they introspect and start getting those measures in place if they don't have them already.
Which is why I asked you that question. You use the word introspect. It's a good word. How do they need to start that process of introspection? What's the next step as far as companies are concerned?
I think the next step as far as companies are concerned is to look at what measures they do have, if they have any. If they don't have any, basically going to the drawing board and saying, okay, how do we start this process? And a good way to start is to look at the nature of your business and conduct a risk assessment of the specific corruption risks that you face. Once you do a meaningful risk assessment and understand the specific risks that you face, you can then map out the rest of the procedures and controls that you need to implement in your particular business to make sure that whatever you do is going to meaningfully mitigate corruption risk within your organization.
Just give me a very quick answer in conclusion. If you need to do a risk assessment in terms of corruption within an organization, what are you looking for? What would those red flags be?
You're looking for high-risk areas. So if I use one particular example, let's say your business is the kind of business that needs to obtain certain government licenses and that sort of thing, and you may use an agent to obtain that particular license. That is generally considered to be a high-risk environment for corrupt activity, because historically many agents have been found guilty of corrupt activity in the past. And so there is an area that you as a business would look at and say, well, that's a high-risk area, and I need to develop measures to mitigate that risk. So I need to have appropriate measures and contractual arrangements with my agent to make sure that they don't engage in that kind of activity when they're doing business for us and on behalf of our particular businesses. So that's just one example. Mm-hmm. But it's basically looking at areas where in your business, there is a risk that a bribe could be paid or a bribe could be received. So, for example, in a sales function, that's another one, because people are working on incentives. And so what you want to prevent is, you know, an area of perhaps clients or customers possibly trying to induce employees in your organizations
right.
to act in a way that they shouldn't act by receiving and paying bribes.
Well, I would imagine a lot of hard work is going to begin in that respect. Zakir Mohammed, thank you very much indeed for the explanation.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
In January this year, South Africa witnessing the closure of 109 businesses, marking a substantial 35% surge from the corresponding period last year. According to the latest data from Stats SA, there was a notable 34.6% uptick in the overall number of liquidations in January this year compared to January last year. In conversation now with Vincent Munkel, who is the director of the dispute resolution practice at the law firm Cliff Dekker Hofmeyer. And Vincent, first of all then, given the significant rise in closure and liquidation reported by Stats SA, what are the factors that are driving this trend?
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Good afternoon to your listeners. In the main, companies going to liquidation for two reasons. One is the inability to pay debt. So a lot of companies are really under financial distress at the moment. And there's a lot of factors that contribute to that. The load shedding issue is a big issue. The economy is not really doing that well. So those are the main reasons that then companies are going into liquidation.
And these are all sizes of companies, aren't they?
That is so. That is correct. As you say, there's been, I think, about a 34.6% uptake in overall liquidation numbers in January 2024 compared to the same time last year.
So how does the legal framework as it exists in South Africa right now support struggling businesses, either to help them restructure or to avoid liquidation?
That is a good question. So what the Companies Act did in 2008, so the Act was introduced in 2008 and it took effect in 2011. So that was about 13 years ago. What it did, it introduced a concept called business rescue. And the stated purpose of business rescue is to promote innovation, investment in the African market, and also to provide a framework for the rescue of companies. And that is done in two ways. But before I get there, let me just maybe explain why companies would go under business rescue. The test for business rescue is financial distress. So that means if a company is unlikely to pay its debt, or unlikely to be insolvent in the next 6 months, then it's a prime candidate for business rescue. And the purpose of that business rescue would be to avoid that company going into liquidation.
So under what circumstances then might a company opt for liquidation over business rescue or vice versa?
So if a company is insolvent, so if its liabilities exceed its asset, then it shouldn't go into business rescue. It should go into liquidation. However, if it's only in financial distress, so, you know, there are likely challenges, you know, in the next 6 months, they won't be able to pay their debtors, or they might be insolvent. That is a prime candidate for business rescue because it's not in insolvency, it's in financial distress. How it works is then the business rescue process will then start. There'll be a BRP that's appointed, and that BRP basically takes the supervision of the company in an effort to restructure the affairs of the company so that it can continue to exist on a solvent basis.
What are the risks attached to that process?
So there are a couple of risks. I think the first one would be the fact that if it goes into business rescue too late, so it has passed that financial distress, it's now insolvent. In those circumstances, it's unlikely that business rescue will work because it will not be insolvent. So there's that risk that it might not work. The other risk is if there is no cooperation between all the affected persons. So those would be your employees, those would be all the creditors, those would be unions. If there's no cooperation, in those circumstances, it's very difficult for business rescue to work. Obviously, the business rescue practitioner has wide powers, but it really requires the cooperation of all the stakeholders in order to save the business.
One of the problems is the business rescue practitioner wants to stay on in the job as long as possible because it's a revenue stream.
Yeah, we have seen those instances, but I must say the courts have come quite hard on those business rescue practitioners who do that. So the test is if a business rescue practitioner, one of the requirements is that in order for him to continue as a business rescue practitioner, he has to believe that there's a reasonable prospect of rescuing the business. If he doesn't, he has to put it in liquidation. If the company obviously is rescuable, it's advisable for him to continue as long as possible. But it can be indefinite. The period put in the Act is about 3 months. But in practice, you know, you'll see business rescue practitioners or business rescue process going on as long as, let's say, 6 months. let's say about 2 a year.
How do you determine if a company is rescuable?
So it's not an easy question. One thing that we do is, or advise clients as well as business rescue practitioners, is to, before you can make that determination as to whether to put the business rescue, the company business rescue, you must perform basically what we refer to as a pre-assessment. So you must then look at, you know, what debts are in the entity. You must look at the order book, the pipeline, and then you sort of have to then make that determination to say, well, this company has this type of orders that are coming in the next 6 months or in the next 12 months. There's an availability of sort of post-commencement finance. Let's say your funders are willing to fund the company. You know, having considered all those factors, you can then make a determination to say, okay, this company is rescuable, and you then put it in business rescue. But however, having put it in business rescue, once you form a view that as a business rescue practitioner, that it's no longer, there is no longer a reasonable prospect of rescuing the company, there's an obligation on you as a business rescue practitioner to then terminate the business rescue proceedings.
Vincent Manco, thank you very much indeed from Cliff Decker Hoffmeyer.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Special Investigating Unit has hosted the inaugural meeting of the Border Management and Immigration Anti-Corruption Forum, and it's focused on preventing and combating corruption in this particular space. Advocate Andy Motibi is the head of the SIU. He joins us now on MoneyWeb at Midday. And Advocate, first of all then, what's the purpose of the initiative, and perhaps more importantly, the intended outcome?
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Jeremy. What has driven this inaugural meeting for government to strengthen anti-corruption efforts in the border management and immigration space? It's really a sequel from the rollout of the National Anti-Corruption Strategy. And the National Anti-Corruption Strategy, as you may know, has got six pillars. And the sixth pillar states that government and the civil society has to collaborate in the protection of the sectors that are vulnerable to corruption. So we have done a risk assessment as members of the anti-corruption task team, which is currently called Crime Operational Committee. So the risk assessment came up with various sectors now, but we have prioritized the following sectors to implement the model that we have now also implemented in the border management and immigration space. The model says we need to involve civil society, business, labor, government in the fight against corruption. So the first model was implemented in 2019 in the health sector. So we took the sector approach, the health sector, and we really named that the anti-corruption forums. The health sector anti-corruption forum was launched by the president, because that really was the first model in 2019. So since then, we have really seen that it works. How it happens is it mobilizes, galvanizes the stakeholders in a particular sector. In the health sector, or in all the sectors, will mobilize civil society, regulators, labor, and other non-governmental organizations.
Advocate Motibi, if I can just come across there, it does sound like you're moving in the right direction. Specifically, as far as the borders are concerned, what type of corruption will you be looking at and prioritizing?
Right, wonderful. Thank you very much for that. So, as you know, Jeremy, to prioritize border management and immigration space, we took account of public comments, we took account of some of the reports, and we actually even received some of the allegations relating to border management and immigration corruption. So, and that led, amongst others, to the president signing a proclamation, which was issued in February this year, Proclamation R-154. So the kind of corruption we'll be looking at is the issuance of permanent residence permits, the issue around corporate visas, the issue around business visas, the issue around critical and exceptional skills for work visas, study visas as well, retired persons visas, work visas, and citizenship by naturalization, where the sort of evidence has pointed that there's corruption in this area, but there's also corruption in the access on the border gates themselves, you know, by people entering the Republic through facilitation by, and we have found that some officials play a role in this of individuals or goods or other illicit activities at the border. So,
right. So, Advocate Mutibi, let me say then, you've got Proclamation 154. That gives you a bigger stick, so to speak. But I guess the problem is whether you and your partners will have the sufficient capacity and resources to effectively tackle what is a long laundry list of problems. That's going to be your single biggest issue, isn't it?
Indeed, Jeremy. So what we have done, in fact, we anticipated that this proclamation would be issued when it was taken through the process to be, you know, signed off by the Minister of Justice and also by the President. So in the interim, as we were waiting for this to be processed and signed, we ensured that we recruit and get resources on board. But we are also going to be collaborating with the Border Management Authority and the Department of Home Affairs, the Minister of Home Affairs. In fact, even before the proclamation, had commissioned some of the investigations internally. So we are going to be roping in some of those resources. So we are ready. In fact, the teams have hit the ground running as we speak. There's a case in point which has already received attention in the Northwest Development Corporation, which was publicized. You may be aware of that. A person who came from Zimbabwe. Evidence points that his access into the country was obtained fraudulently. The evidence will be, the investigations is almost finalized. Home Affairs has done an investigation. Northwest government has done investigation. So that's really one of the sort of the first and foremost case that we are wrapping up, and we will, in fact, consequence management. This case, amongst others, has also pointed us in other directions. There's abuse of inactive system, which is in the transport environment. There's some, you know, sort of fraudulent, corrupt activities happening there, because this person ended up having some, you know, licenses that you know, and it actually even opening up other areas that we need to look at. Now, on a bigger scale, we are going to be looking at various cases of similar nature. We're also going to be looking at the asylum seekers system. Although I am informed by the officials at the Home Affairs that the risk there has probably gone a bit low because it's probably under control. But right. We're going to look at it as well.
Advocate Andy Mutibi, thank you very much indeed for that explanation. You've got that proclamation. Let's see how it pans out. I appreciate you joining me on today's edition of MoneyWeb at Midday. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Transport Minister says Gauteng motorists will still be held liable for paying their e-toll fees until the system's official closure. The midnight closure follows years of anger when the system would eventually end. Many people, many organizations refusing to pay their e-toll fees. With us now is Reginald Demana, who is the Chief Executive Officer of SANRAL, that's the South African National Roads Agency. And first of all, then, what actually happens when those gantries go dark?
Yeah, so at midnight, we switch off the system. By switching off the system, really, it means that all the transactions that get recorded when you pass the gantries are not then loaded into any profile. So the system rejects them as illegitimate transactions. In addition, we also make sure that your individual accounts will record all the e-toll transactions as zero. So that's the second layer of protection. And from there on, the cameras and the gantries will continue to capture information, vehicle information, plate numbers, and all of that. And that's really for reason of crime fighting and law enforcement. And of course, for invoicing, it means we no longer send you any invoices from the e-toll from the 12th April because there are no transactions to be sent to you. However, all the transactions that you would have done until midnight will continue to be processed. So you might still get an invoice later in the week, in the next 2 weeks, just reflecting your activity until midnight.
Could you explain to me what the position is with any outstanding debt that motorists will have once the system goes dark?
So that decision on outstanding debt, really, the legacy debt for this, has not yet been made, whether we will continue to collect or to pursue it, has not yet been made. So is the decision on whether we must refund those who have been paid or not. But in the meantime, until that decision is made, the law requires that we keep collecting. So indeed, we will gladly accept payments for those who pay, but we are not prosecuting. We haven't been doing that since March 2019, and that status quo will remain.
So when do you expect that decision to be made, and who makes the decision?
National government, in conjunction with the Gauteng province, have committed to processing that. We don't have a definitive timeline. They've said that what they would like to do is to consult the public as well as other interested and affected stakeholders. As you can imagine, you have a number of key account holders like your fleet management, rental and leasing companies, banks and others that have implemented systems to use the e-toll and invested heavily. So we also need to take into account what their input is regarding a way forward. And of course, another stakeholder is SARS. A lot of tax implications that has to be taken into account in any of the decisions we made.
I would be very interested in your assessment as the chief executive as to why this initiative failed to get off the ground. You must have spent a lot of time self-reflecting on this.
I think you do. Naturally, you do these sort of things. Jeremy, first and foremost, engineers love building things. And that's what they specialize on. And I think a lot of engineers felt that they delivered very good quality infrastructure, and that's what they were focused on. Lots of time pressures because some of the roads had to be completed before the World Cup. The minister has already said it might be that in that haste, we did not do proper consultation, or the consultation was not deep enough for people to understand the financial consequences in their pockets. So that's something that I think has been accepted, that we could have done things differently. If you then look at us internally, one of the lessons we have learned is that urban tolling is not something we'll want to do again. So we will stick to the conventional boom gate, you stop and pay. That's the model we'll stick to, because compliance in that space is 99.99%.
So are we going to see more of those boom gates put up to replace the e-tolling?
No, not to replace the e-tolling. I think the conversations that we want to have, we have a so-called roads funding policy that's coming out, which will be up for public consultation on how we fund roads nationally going forward at all different spheres of government. And within there, some of the things that might come up will be, what do you do with increased trucks on the roads? Do you maybe have certain routes that target tolling fees for trucks just to encourage them to go back on rail? But of course, when you do that, you must also have freight rail functioning properly. So those are some of the options that I think we will put on the table.
So Reginald, e-tolling now in its current incarnation is a thing that is over. What impact might this have on road maintenance?
Well, I guess, Jeremy, if you consider the fact that our collection rate has been less than 20% during the duration of this scheme, and we didn't really do a lot of maintenance on these roads. Now, what we have done is government has decided that these roads will be maintained using National Treasury grants. The backlog maintenance, Gauteng will contribute some 4.1 billion just to make sure that we do the type of maintenance we're doing on the R21, where certain surfaces are long overdue to be refreshed. So that will be done in the next 2 to 3 years. But going forward, they will be funded from the grants we receive from National Treasury.
I am going to leave it there. Reginald Damana, Chief Executive Officer at the South African National Roads Agency. Thank you. And that's where we're going to leave it for this week. MoneyWeb at midday, live at noon weekdays, and then we're up as a podcast. Have a good weekend. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.